only learning a lot about lynchings after so many years?
I think part of the problem is it's a part of our history that we don't want to talk about. One of really terrorism against African Americans in the South, especially men. And we tend to think of them as, oh, you know, this is a product of bad men being pursued by these crazy mobs. But in reality, these were community events in which the local communities was prominent in taking these persons and hanging them for some accusation of having committed some crimes. And I think what has been changing recently is that we are having a lot of initiatives that start to think about these victims of lynchings as a really victim of terrorism.
What were the years where lynchings were prominent, and what had touched them off?
Well, usually the end of Reconstruction, that's where really we see lynchings taking off. Federal troops leave the South. African Americans don't have any more protection. But from a legal perspective, all their rights tend to be stripped. And also, they don't have any physical protection. Again, federal troops are gone. So who's going to be protecting them? Well, nobody. And lynching becomes a mechanism to get rid of people that are seen undesirable.
So what years do we see, the first and the last?
Towards the end of the 1870s and then really 1930s, 1940s, that's when lynchings tend to disappear, which does not mean that racial violence disappears. It's just that now spectacle lynchings are not acceptable anymore.
Late 1870s to 1930s, even 40s?
Yes. 1946, we have one of the worst lynching in the United States. It was in Monroe, Georgia. It was a quadruple lynching of two couples, two African-American couples. One of the women was also 7 months pregnant. They shot them on the way from prison where they were being released.
And why had they ostensibly done this to these two couples?
Well, they were accused of committing some kind of crimes. They were put in jail. Their white employer had paid the fine, and they were taking them back to their farm and were ambushed in a bridge, and that's where we're lynched.
How many lynchings, roughly, that we know of throughout the United States?
Between 4,000 and 5,000.
Do we believe that there were many more than what we know to have been?
Absolutely. This is an underestimation of the real number. If these lynchings were not recorded in newspapers, there is basically no way for us to record them or count them.
What did you learn about how locals covered lynchings?
Well, that's very interesting because there is definitely a discrepancy between what the local newspapers were saying and what the national newspapers were saying. Local newspapers tend to provide a little bit more details. They would often be very defensive, praising the mobs because they would be bring back order, serving justice. Again, there would be a lot of apologetic and justification for what happened.
Give me an example of a typical one.
Well, you can find newspapers saying, last night justice was served because such and such person was lynched by this mob led by the most prominent citizen of the community.
No, they did not say the most prominent citizens.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They would very often try to justify what happened in terms of the popular sentiment is widely shared that justice was made, and that sent a signal to everyone else. If you're going to be doing something similar, that's what's going to happen to you. And everybody's really happy with this kind of message.
So why did mobs do this? We already had somebody arrested, perhaps unfairly, perhaps not, and who was going to go through the justice system.
Because they didn't trust the justice system. They wanted a form of a popular justice in which the citizen, the local community, has a right in their own views of taking the law into their own hands. And also because it was clear that you are sending a signal to the rest of the community. So you don't want just to have justice in the ordinary sense. You want to show the body to the rest of the community. The point is not just to kill. The point is to show and leaving the bodies hanging for a few days sometimes.
How maddening to be the family of these victims and to find out time and time again, nobody, when there were dozens of people there, nobody was identified or prosecuted.
Oh, absolutely. It was an outrage. And that was part of the lynching as an institution. Again, lynching is not just a product of a few crazy people wanting to get revenge. Here we're talking about community affairs in which there is a complicity of the local authorities, maybe the sheriff, the mayor, the local judge. Very often they would know exactly who was responsible or who was part of those mobs, but they would not do anything about it.
All of these stories are so tragic, but are there a couple in particular that you've come across in this database of Virginia lynchings that you could share with me, the stories behind them?
Yes. I think one of the cases is about the lynching of Charlotte Harris in Harrisonburg in 1878. She was the only African-American woman to have been lynched in Virginia that we know of. And she was accused of instigating the burning of a barn of a prominent rich white farmer. And so she escaped, and she was found in Albemarle County, and she was taken to Harrisonburg before a magistrate, and then she was put in jail awaiting for trial. So then at night, a dozen people or so came to the house of this jailer and took her from the jailers, and they hanged her to a tree, and they left her body hanging for almost 3 days. For what we know from newspapers, it's very likely that she had nothing to do with the burning of this barn.
What caused lynching to end? In Virginia, it actually ended not long after Raymond Byrd, the man who was lynched in Wytheville, was killed in 1926.
Yes, there was another case in 1927 in West County, Virginia, the lynching of Leonard Woods in 1927. Really, that was the case that sparked the Virginia government to pass anti-lynching legislation in 1928.
Why did they bother?
There was a campaign for years by especially newspapers to try to pass some form of legislation against lynching. The Virginia governors, they were always been very reluctant to pass this form of legislation, but in the end they were convinced, not so much from trying to protect African-American victims, but really as a way of showing that Virginia was becoming part of the New South in terms of being willing to attract business and capital.
Did the other states soon follow?
Well, I take issue with the fact that lynching stopped in 1928. So what happens after 1928, African-Americans that get killed by mobs, they're not lynched anymore, but they commit suicide or they disappear so that there is no legal consequences for this act. So, for example, the lynching of Shedrick Thompson in 1932, it's a textbook case of someone who was lynched by a mob, but the local coroner, the local authorities ruled it as a suicide, so there was no investigation of it. And even though there was also a big hole in the skull of Shedrick Thompson, he ruled it as a suicide rather than, of course, a lynching.
Oh, wow. What a travesty.
Yes, absolutely.
What advice do you have for communities and citizens who'd like to shed more light on this in their own communities across the country? What sorts of things can they do that would really memorialize these victims?
One of them is through historical markers, you know, the one that we see throughout United States that commemorates some kind of like, you know, civil wars and kind of heroes. You can have those kind of historical markers being erected. Another way is working with the Equal Justice Initiative, in which in their museum in Montgomery, Alabama, they have these steel markers with the name of all the victims of lynching for each county. So each county can actually ask to bring back these particular steel markers and put them in some kind of symbolic place in their county. There is also the Soil Remembrance Program, in which soil is collected from the places where lynching have happened, and they put in a jar and sent to this museum as a way of commemorating the places where this lynching have taken place.
Gianluca DeFazio is a professor of justice studies at James Madison University. His database is called Racial Terror, Lynching in Virginia, 1877 to 1927. In 1962, at the centennial of the Civil War, a man named Ralph Ginsberg published a book called 100 Years of Lynchings. It cataloged newspaper accounts of racialized lynchings that took place throughout the previous century. Many of the accounts cited the names of the victims. Dr. Renee Hill is the former chair of the History and Philosophy Department at Virginia State University. where she organized two memorial services to victims of racialized lynching, using Ginsburg's book as a source. Dr. Hill has since retired, and she joins me now to talk about the powerful experience of naming as remembrance. Renee, last year you created a deeply moving memorial service to all the people who've been victimized by racialized lynching in America. What moved you to do that?
An African philosopher, John Mbidi, wrote that as long as the departed person is remembered by name, he is not really dead. I taught a class in African philosophy, and when I read that quotation by Mbidi, I was really inspired to organize this program. I had also recently read an article about a program where the names of the victims of the Holocaust were read. And so we decided that we wanted to do this in a sacred space. We've done this program twice now, once in the chapel and once in our meditation center last February, called the Oasis. So we had the lights dim. There was quiet background music playing. We opened it with a song, Precious Lord.
Precious Lord.
Sung by one of the members of our gospel choir.
Take my hand, lead me on, and let me stand. I am tired. I am weak. I am lost.
And then a prayer by our campus minister. And then the president of the university, Dr. Abdullah, read the first set of names. So there is a book that has compiled as many names as they have been able to gather of the victims of racially motivated lynching. And as you probably know, there have been almost 3,500 victims of racially motivated lynching here in the U.S. between 1882 and 1968. And they're organized in this book by state. So it'll be Alabama, and then you have the names of the victims of lynching as well as the date and where the lynching took place. And you sit there in the semi-dark, and you listen to name after name after name, sometimes whole families. And it is like a weight is pressing on you harder and harder and harder as you sit there and listen. And what is most poignant for me is that at the end of each state, they have a list where they don't even know the name of the victim. And so it'll say, unknown Negro, and the name of some town, and then the date. And I can only assume that either the body was so disfigured that they couldn't even recognize who it was. The first time we did this, I just wept at that part, because it'll go on and on. Unknown Negro. But I just have to assume that even though we don't know their name, the fact that we know the date and the location, that somehow they are triangulated by the universe and they know somewhere that we're still remembering them. We're still commemorating them. We're still reaching across to hold their hand.
You have done this twice, as you said, and fairly recently. Why now?
Because in some ways it's still going on. The fact that Black life is still considered expendable, that we can still have people shot down in cold blood or strangled, shows that we're still not equating Black lives with the importance of other lives in our country. And so it's not only honoring, commemorating the people who died, you know, after the Civil War at the turn of the 20th century, but it's also thinking about and making us aware of the importance of Black lives right now.
This took place at Virginia State University, an HBCU, an historically Black university, that was founded in 1882. Ironically, 1882 was around the same time that these racially terrorizing lynchings began.
Yes, that period after the Civil War and the Reconstruction period was a terrifying period as whites decided that they could not give up control and decided to fight back by terrorizing us in various creative and cruel ways. So yes, even at the same time that there were positive things, universities being started to help those formerly enslaved to start new lives, at the same time, there were all kinds of brutalities and cruelties going on.
What sort of responses did you hear from people who attended afterward?
Most people felt that it was deeply moving, although it sometimes takes a while to recover. I know it does for me, that there's just this deep sadness that overtakes you when you hear name after name after name of men and women and children over and over who died so brutally and sometimes so disrespectfully when people were watching it as a spectacle, you know? And so it takes a while to come back to center when you're dealing with such cruelty.
Really? Children were lynched?
Mm-hmm. There were entire families.
How could such a thing happen, right?
Yes, well, human beings are capable of great kindness and great cruelty.
What else did you choose for the service? What concluding music?
We concluded with spoken word, which is original poetry that was composed and performed by one of my students who worked in the Oasis, our meditation center. And then the hymn Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, which was sung by a member of the gospel choir, because it talks about coming to take me home. And I would like to share with you the poem by our student, Nursa Backstrom, who composed it and performed it for the first time there at our performance, at our program. Blood on the leaves, blood at the roots, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees, from the poplar trees. Can you see my ancestors? Can you hear their children's cry? The fruit of their labor forced to watch as they rot. America has always thrived on black trauma. They forced us to watch as our families were beaten, raped, and killed. The blood on the leaves is the same blood in the streets. They roped up our ancestors and gunned down our brothers, yet they still say we are the violent ones. They shoot us for having toy guns, yet white males are shooting up churches and being provided a meal. They shoot us for wearing a hoodie. They shoot us in front of our children. They shoot us while our hands are up. They wrap their arms around us so tight and don't even let go, even when we tell them we can't breathe. Have you ever seen a black body turn blue? Have you ever seen people that once looked like you looking like strange fruit? The blood on the leaves is the same as the blood in the streets. They've been lynching us for hundreds of years. Their weapons of destruction have just taken a different form. But the victims still look the same, and the pain still feels the same. But one thing that must remain, we must keep saying their names. No matter the magnitude of pain, no matter how many are slain, we must keep saying their names. We must keep saying their names. Blood on the leaves, blood at the roots, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees, from the poplar trees.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Dr. Renee Hill is the former chair of the History and Philosophy Department at Virginia State University. Earlier, you heard Precious Lord, sung by Charles Chico Wiley. We leave you now with Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, sung by Chiquita L. Cross.
Of angels coming after me, coming for to carry me home. Swing sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
supported community radio, KBOO.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, over 100 national and regional U.S. organizations release a joint statement urging President Biden to end the U.S. role in escalating the dangerous tensions with Russia over the Ukraine. We'll talk to Roots Action co-founder Norman Solomon about that. Also, celebrated troubadour human rights activist and Flashpoints contributor Francisco Herrera fighting for the children and for the life of Julian Assange. Also, we'll feature an in-depth update on the situation in post